Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. I'm very excited that we have today a very, very special guest. We met probably 8 years ago or so at Dragon Con.
Ten years ago.
Wow. At Dragon Con. He was cool, but I totally fell in love with his daughter. She was so cute in her,
It was a hit girl costume.
Yeah. She was just so cute in that. But anyway, we're not talking with her though. So I'm going to introduce you to a world-class fantasy illustrator and artist, Tom Wood. Hi, Tom.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me. It's been an honor just being here and part of the watching you guys do your thing with the event. Everything I've seen so far has just blown me away. And the other guests and the contributing artists and judges are just world-class. So thank you.
You're very, very welcome. But I can assure you, you wouldn't be here if you didn't qualify.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So I guess to start with, since this is the first time we've actually chatted, just so you know, Tom is our latest Illustrators of the Future judge, and we're going to get into why it is that he's a judge for us now. So if you go to his website at
TomWoodFantasyArt.com, I've got a large array of my several of my fantasy art pieces that I've done over the years. It's been licensed, or some that are licensed and still available for licensing, and then others that I've done for musical groups like Insane Clown Posse or, you know, Kiss, Aerosmith, other bands that I've done album covers for.
Oh, just like that? Okay.
Good. Yeah.
So you specialize in fantasy art, but when you go to your website, you got ICP art, which we'll define in a moment, mm-hmm. and then your section on fantasy art, underground collection, and sports art. So the other ones we can like slide by momentarily without people like wondering what the heck is that, but ICP art. So what is that and how did that become to be a thing?
Oh, that's a very interesting and long story. But in my career, I was a sports graphics artist. I had worked for Salem Sportswear in the 90s. And Salem Sportswear did mascots for different college teams and professional teams. And I was in the division that illustrated mascots. So I would take like a North Carolina Tar Heel or a Los Angeles Ram, and I would illustrate their mascot, and we would print it on apparel. It was interesting because, you know, when they would come to me because the fans, they would sell really good, aggressive mascots. But my mascots tended to be extremely aggressive, it seemed. And so especially the college would push back on it and say it's bordering satanic at some point. And really a little, you know, cut it back. It's a little too much. And so anyway, I kind of got a reputation for doing really sinister looking mascots, and which was fine with me. And but years later, my design director, Carrie Gallagher, who's a sweetheart, she went to work with Live Nation. And I had since left the corporate world and began my freelance operation and was doing a lot of advertising work and commercial work under MeridianDesignWorks.com, which is a website that I still have that I sort of cater that to my ad agencies and mm-hmm. places like that. So Carrie called me up and says, we are doing a lot of business with Spencer's and Hot Topics, and Insane Clown Posse is our hottest property. And they've been using these same jokers for years. I would love to see, knowing your style, I would love to see what you could do with it. So it was.
So that's ICP, Insane Clown Posse.
Insane Clown Posse. And these guys have almost a cult-like following. They started in 1992, and they have a million fans on Facebook. And they have a huge following. It's very similar to the Grateful Dead's fans. Grateful Dead fans called Deadheads, but more of an inner city, Midwestern following. And so that was my target audience. Anyway, so they've been looking at these same logos that they had launched with their initial albums for the past 25 years at this point. So when I took their logos and sort of started realizing them in a more of a 3D fashion, more of a realistic look, Hot Topics and Spencer's just jumped on it. And they got in a bidding war with Live Nation, and Hot Topic won. And then Spencer says, I don't know who this Tom Wood guy is, but we want him to do our Insane Clown Posse line. And they said, we'll pay whatever. We'll pay whatever we want. And I'm like, okay, this is, it sounds like I've got some good leverage here. So
with your pinky in your mouth, yeah, $1 million.
I'm like, okay, yeah. Lots of money. But one important thing, you're going to leave my name on there. And they're like, we don't do that. We do not put the artist names on there. Because I guess they would assume that another company may poach me or whatever. And they wanted to keep me in their hip pocket. And I said, well, you just can't have the artwork then. And I'd already done several of them to show them, to entice them, you know. And so they finally, I guess, gave in and said, okay, you can put your name on there. So anyway, the name went out into the public, and Spencer's made a huge display in the stores, and they sold just tons of it, and it was just a huge success. And but most importantly, the Juggalo started asking who Tom Wood is. You know, when was the next Tom Wood piece coming out? And so I did probably 40, 50 pieces through Live Nation over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. And then Psychopathic finally got wise and said, why are we going to Live Nation to work with Tom Wood when we can just work with Tom Wood? So they contacted me, and for the past 6 years, I've just been working directly with that label.
Wow, it's amazing.
It is. And in 2016, they asked me to do, they have something called Dark Carnival Games, and that's a game company that Rob Bruce, who is like a master gamer, designs these games. And he brought me in to design over 300 cards for this deck building game. And invited me out to their huge musical festival called The Gathering of the Juggalos. And I was like, Rob, I'm from a little town in Arkansas. I don't have any tattoos. I don't smoke. I don't have any piercings. I'm not sure that I'm going to fit in with your crowd. And he says, no, you just got to come out and see it for yourself. I think these people are going to love you. So I went out there tentatively. And sure enough, probably the most appreciative, respectful fans that I've ever met.
With their Harleys and their
Harleys,
their guns and their tattoos and their
I don't know about guns, but actually they've been fighting this FBI gang label since 2012, and which was just, it's ridiculous. There may be a few bad seeds, but if you went to the Gathering of Juggalos, there's no fights, there's no rapings, there's no thievery. If you went to a Metallica concert, I would almost promise you that there would be 10 times as much as that. And there's, you know, nobody says a word about that. But anyway, it's just an unjustly, you know, place label.
No, I'm tracking with that totally. So that's that category that you have there of the underground. That's the underground collection?
Yes, the underground collection is, Insane Clown Posse is pretty much the godfathers of that entire musical scene. Now you have other bands and that's come along that sort of look to these guys as, you know, the leader of this underground movement. And so I've done design works for some of the smaller bands too, and I put that in the underground collection.
So when you do these album covers, because we've had some of our judges before, we had Frank Kelly Freese has that one cover that he did with the giant robot holding the person in his hand that's dead, you know.
Yes. Yep.
That was the cover for was it Rolling Stones? It was one of the one of the big bands in the 60s.
I think it was Rolling Stones, actually.
Yeah. And so that's just so cool. How'd you get onto the line with doing cover albums for these big bands?
Well, again, that was mostly Live Nation.
Live Nation.
When I had first started out doing apparel designs for their concert tours. And they were doing so well with these shirts, then they started saying, well, you know, this guy's shirt artwork looks better than our labels or than our album covers. So let's start asking Tom to do our album covers for us. So then that's how it sort of naturally progressed into that.
Wow, because it was in through the Live Nation line, not through the actual album label.
Right. It was
that's interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of just proving yourself with some kind of, you know, baptism of fire, doing apparel, and then just graduating up. And I think all artists kind of go through that growth process where they have to prove themselves in, you know, a smaller venue, and then get to graduate up to the bigger projects.
Now you do, I said, you've got this ICP, Fantasy Art Underground Collection, and Sports Art. So,
right, the Sports Art, like I said, when I first started my career, of course, I come from a tiny town called Mammoth Spring, Arkansas, with a population of about 800 people. My graduating class is about 18. Everyone's dirt poor. You know, we're in the middle of Arkansas, which is fine because, you know, we really didn't see money out there. So there was no cliques. There wasn't rich kids and poor kids in this side of town. We're all just in it together. And but we didn't have money for art classes. We didn't have, you know, anything like that. So if you wanted to do art, then you just had to do it on your own. And that was my humble beginnings. But when you decide that you want to be an artist in the middle of rural Arkansas, you have to think, what the hell am I going to do with art here? Who needs artists? And so I got into screen printing. And that's the only people that had art departments that I could find. So once I moved into that, I quickly moved from, I think I started my first screen printing job when I was 20 or 19, and then as assistant art director, became art director within a month because the people I worked for were just crooks, and they knew that they were paying me half as much as the art director. So they fired him and then made me their first 19-year-old art director. And then I did that for 3 years and learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And then the headhunters started coming looking for, you know, talent. And then that's when Salem Sportswear found me and recruited me up to Hudson, New Hampshire, to work on their sports programs. So once I got up there, I was doing caricatures and college mascots and stuff like that. And it just, so sports apparel and sports graphics is just ingrained in me. I've done it for so many years. So, and that once I left the corporate world and the sports apparel world, that seemed to follow me into my advertising stuff too, because, mm-hmm. you know, Pepsi and everybody uses sports for their advertising. So it's been a nice feather in my hat over the years.
So all these things with ICP Art, Underground Collection, Sports Art, those are all active pursuits that you still create art for.
But if you went to meridiandesignworks.com, you'll see a lot of the advertising companies that I still do a lot of work for, like Pepsi and the NFL, MLB, World Wrestling Entertainment, just to mention a few. There's too many to really mm-hmm. remember, but that's just a few of the highlights. But I still do work for all those advertising agencies, on top of trying to continue building my fantasy art collection and pursuing this underground thing that seems to have taken on a life of its own. And I have a huge fan following with the Juggalos, and it's allowed me to open up a store and sell prints with, you know.
In your 800 population town?
Yes, yes. Yeah, we have way more cows than people in my town, that's for sure.
So how does somebody go in a town of 800 people, no art school there at all, no art education, and how much was the internet a factor? It wasn't there when you
there was
started.
No internet.
There was no internet. There was
Absolutely.
No social media. So it was like,
no.
What'd you do to, how'd you get started? How'd you launch? Was it like you had your crayons and your white wall that
right. well,
you just kept
you
on
just
repainting
kinda...
and...
You just kind of punch out in lots of different directions, hoping that certain doors may open and, you know, shine a light in the direction that you're supposed to go. Because my father was he's a cattle rancher. And before that, he was a USDA inspector. And so there was no artist in my family to sort of give me any kind of guidance as far as what to do. I was in 10th grade, and my math teacher says, why don't you start doing political cartoons for the local paper? So I started, you know, I was the political cartoon guy in 10th grade for my little town. And that's how my art career really got started. And then
you kept on getting busted in class
no,
drawing instead of paying attention?
No, actually my teachers are so supportive. They would they just looked forward to seeing all the little sketches and doodles that I would do on the paper. And my algebra teacher was the one that would be feeding me, hey, Tom, this is a great political story. I'm in 10th grade. I don't know anything about politics. Like, this is what's happening in this school, and you need to do this, and this would be funny. So he would feed me these ideas. And then I would do it in his class sometimes. You know, as long as I finished his little, you know, his little project, I would just start sketching, and I would show him, and he would give me feedback. Mr. Carlisle just recently passed, but he was a huge influence on me putting art, having the guts to put it out there and more of a public, viewing for something like that, instead of showing my friends and knowing that everyone was going to pat me on the back and tell me I was great. So it was good.
I get it. So were your family supportive? Because if your dad's a rancher, it would seem like he'd probably be more inclined to trust in the more proven methods of livelihood.
Yes.
Like ranching or becoming a doctor.
Right.
Or.
And you're right. I think over the years, I'm sure him and my mom, who were both extremely supportive, I'm sure they was like, they thought this may be something that would come to, it would sort of resolve itself at some point.
he'll come to his senses.
Right. Once he goes hungry long enough, then he's going to go get a job. And, but no, I was lucky enough that they were always supportive. They always took everything that I brought home or any kind of art competition, or if I entered in the local fair and won, you know, they would just be very supportive.
That's great.
They put it up on the, everything went up on the refrigerator.
Yeah, I was going to say, made it on the refrigerator.
Yes. So when I actually got hired when I was 19 for an art job, they started thinking, he may actually pull this shit off, you know, so this may be great. And sure enough, like I said, once I moved from assistant art director to art director, and then was hired by one of the largest apparel companies in the country to do work for them. They was like, okay, he's found it. He's going to be fine.
That's good. So next question. Okay, when are you going to move out of the house, son? Lather was 30 years old today. So, I mean, that's fascinating because a lot of artists have that. There's a problem with also with writing too, where you get used to having a job of like, you're up to making $50, $60, $70, $90, $100,000 a year doing the regular job.
Mm-hmm.
And then the transition doing art to writing a book, it means you're going to do a serious pay cut.
Right.
If you know, speaking with Dan Dos Santos, he didn't want to do that. He said, I'd never want to work anything other than doing art. And so he worked out a budget where he said, I needed $200 a month. I lived in my parents' basement. I needed $200 to buy food and pay for my, you know, bus. And then he just built up from there, and he's never had to work any other type of job other than doing his art. And what you did, even if you're, you know, art director or doing something in the studio making art, that's still art, you know?
Right.
So how was your, did you always just keep it with art all throughout your career? Or
right. I've never had another job other than artwork. That's doing art. I think the biggest leap that I made was leaving the corporate world and starting my own company, Meridian Design Works, and then eventually Tomwood Fantasy Art after that. But that jump was kind of, or that transition was kind of fast-forwarded in 1998. I'd taken over art direction for the special events program at Starter. And, of course, this was during the Michael Jordan era, so we were selling millions of shirts. Hot Markets went from 3 million when I arrived to 33 million within 3 years, and we were killing it. Unfortunately, the rest of the company was bleeding. It was just bleeding money. The shoes were crashing. The jackets weren't selling anymore. And David Beckerman, who was the owner, pulled us all onto the second floor in New Haven, Connecticut. I remember it like it was yesterday. And announced that Starter is closing its doors. And you're free to go. And he just showed us out into the parking lot that day with no former notice. And I vowed to myself that day that I would never work for someone else and put my future in the hands of someone else besides me. If I failed from at this point, I was going to be the only one responsible for it. And that's in 1998, I started Meridian Design Works, and that's never looked back.
That's great. And then you've got a family. You own half of Mississippi now.
No, I have a small, well, small. I have a decent-sized ranch in Arkansas. I have like 310 acres that my family owns, just me and my wife and daughter. And my father has probably 500 or 600 acres. We have, you know, several hundred cows that we take care of every year. So, it's great being able to be on a farm. It's being able to step away from artwork and being so creative and just involved in it. I can walk out the door and then it's just, I'm back to my childhood. I'm taking care of cows. We're herding them and working them and selling them. And it's just, you know, you get to forget all that and you get to be in this beautiful landscape where you get to do it at, surrounded by family. And then once, but when that pull to be creative comes along again, it's just a matter of walking back into the studio and just turning that switch back on. But at least I'm able to turn it off for a little bit and just be Tom again instead of, you know, Tom Wood illustrator.
Right. So now when you do your art, what type of mediums do you use? Are you multiple or is it just primarily Photoshop or?
Well, I have several different styles. I try to keep it a big variety because I don't want to get bored with any certain style. But I guess I'm mostly well known for my photorealistic looks. But I do logo design and page layout and, you know, everything that an advertising agency might come to me for, I've been able to master it over the years. So, you know, I'm happy doing any kind of style. But yes, when I was a child, we would have this local fair. And at the time, they would have games and stuff like that. But there was always this airbrush booth that they would set up. And they would have, you know, Tanya and Ricky with hearts on it. And they'd be airbrushing. I would just be completely, just enthralled watching this guy, you know, pull these airbrushes up and put together these paintings in minutes. And it was so smooth and fluid the way he would work, and I was like, I need to do that. So airbrushing is how I started. And once Photoshop came along with either the Wacoms or the Cintiq pads, it was a very easy transition going from a Pache airbrush to Photoshop with a Wacom pen. So, and that's how I still do my illustrations.
So now, didn't you or do you do statues? Or
I do sculptures,
yeah, I remember sculptures from your booth 10 years ago or so at Dragon Con.
Yes, well, I've done several statues and was able to sell them to several good collections over the years. But the dragons that you've seen at the booth were actually some of the licensing. And licensing has been a huge thing in my career. I was introduced to some licensing agents in the early 2000s that wanted to take several of my dragon pieces and then license them. And Pacific Trading was a company at the time that did a lot of sculptures, and they licensed almost all my dragons at this point. And they took them and they did the sculptures and hand-painted them in resin, and they were just beautiful, and they've sold out since. But, you know, that was a big day for me, being able to see those illustrations kind of come to life in 3D.
So it was an illustration that they then made into...
Right.
The statue. Have you yourself done statues?
Absolutely. Yes. I've done statues that I've sold individually. I usually would do them out of Sculpey because I never would cast them and mass produce them. I would just do one-offs for certain collectors that ask for them and just sell them directly to them.
Wow. So the subject of art itself, so you've obviously succeeded with that. When you've got the whole thing of how to make a livelihood out of it. So you did stuff, so you left corporate. How did you know, that transition, you're getting into the nitty-gritty of it. So it's fine, okay, I'm not going to sell my soul to corporate anymore. I'm going to forge on my own, and I'm going to do it.
Right.
So what do you do to do it?
Well, luckily, when Starter closed its doors, it was in New Haven, Connecticut. And between Waterbury and Danbury, Connecticut, is probably the biggest congestion of ad agencies in the world. I mean, they were just lying down the street. Ryan Partnership, Tracy Locke, D'Angelo, DDB, all these ad agencies were right there. And so it was just a matter of, and Silverman Group was the first one that I started working with. And I had worked with them while I was art director at Starter. So they already knew me and they started approaching me. And it seems like the ad agency industry is very incestuous as far as you work for one art director and then all of a sudden they get hired at TLP and they take you there. And then all the other art directors see what they're working on and like who's doing that art for you. So it just sort of naturally spread in that industry. And so that worked out very well for many years. And so it was just ad agency piece after ad agency piece. And not the most enjoyable work. I mean, it paid really well, and it was certainly challenging, but it wasn't the reason that I got into artwork in the first place. You know, when I was 8 years old and I seen that, what was it, Molly Hatchet cover with Frank Frazetta's Death Dealer on it, and I was like, this is what
cool.
I want to do.
This is cool.
This is what I want to do. So I was like, who did this? Frank Frazetta. Oh, he did these two. He did this entire chronology of Conan. Have you seen these? I'm like, no. So I had to bought all those books, read all the, in sixth grade, read the entire chronology of Conan by Robert E. Howard with covers done by Frank Frazetta. And I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. So, and then I couldn't get enough of it. I kept buying Savage Sword of Conan that was put out by Marvel, and a lot of the covers was done by Joe Jusco, who was doing their cover paintings. And I'm like, I don't really want to do the panels. That didn't, you know, that wasn't holding my attention and making me stare at it for hours. But the cover pieces was just so beautiful, and that's really what I wanted to excel at. So, but I didn't know how to get there. So, screen printing went into advertising, and advertising did well, and it sort of built me the padding financially to where I could start exploring the fantasy art at the age of 30, which I really wanted to start when I was 19, but I had to go through this process. I had to find my way to get back to what made me want to be an artist to begin with. So, and even now, I still do advertising stuff. I still, anything that I leave for a while, I kind of miss it, that I've done for a while, whether it that be sports, you know, sports graphics or rock and roll or ad agency work. I always like to go back and still do it a little bit just to keep everything fresh. So
I get it. How much do you do just for yourself, where you just do your own personal pieces, not commission or anything else, and then say, this is really nice, and then sell it just? Or is that what these other things are? This is my fantasy world. This is what I want to do. It's not commission. I do it, and then they buy it because they want it.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about licensing. And what an artist had told me years ago was, don't ever sell your work. You know, try not to. Once you sign that dotted line and promise them that you're going to hand over these files, it's gone forever. You're missing the boat. The best thing is, you're not going to get paid for it, and it's going to suck. But you're going to get to keep that piece. And then if you find the right agent or agency to represent you, then you can license that to lots of different entities, and they can pay you royalties, and you get to keep your artwork. And that's what I was able to do. I was lucky to find Be Creative at one point, and they took me so far into the licensing, and then Tate Licensing, which was probably the largest fantasy art licensing company in the country, picked me up, and has just done really well for me. So, and like even the work that I do for Insane Clown Posse, they don't commission me. They will request it, but I don't charge them for it. I keep that artwork and it's mine. And then I will make a co-license with Psychopathic Records, and then we'll sell it together.
Wow. So this is the first time I've actually had this is a conversation with someone. So you own everything that you've got, but then you don't do oil. You don't do the stuff where you've made it and then you make copies of it. It's all, this is Photoshop stuff. So you actually have, it's almost like an intellectual property because you've got
right.
it.
Right. You know. Yeah. It's all digital at this point, but it sort of lends itself to licensing because let's say you want to do, once you build it, you can format it very quickly and easily for apparel, or you can take that same artwork and then you can expand the canvas and reformat it for beach towels or whatever somebody wants to put on there. It's much easier to do that from a digital standpoint than it is from scanning a canvas and trying to build it like that. You can move things around or change your background to fit whatever product it's going on very quickly.
I get it. So now when you, you know, come with these different ideas that you have, is this this, you go to bed at night and you wake up in the morning like, aha, this is my clown this time? Or how do you come up with your different ideas? Because fantastical art, by very definition, is fantastical. It's not like the real life stuff. It's got a that twist to it, that special thing that makes it not what you see in front of you right now.
That's a great question, John. I'm usually, whatever project I'm working on, I usually have a sketch pad that's right next to me, and something will inspire me, or it's just a flash of a vision, and I'll just do a quick thumbnail. I'll take a break from whatever project I'm working on, whether it's NASCAR or whatever, and stop working on that, and then I'll doodle this little sketch, and I'm like, I'm going to come back to you. You know, don't worry. I'm not forgetting you. And then I'll go ahead and I'll finish my project and get paid for it. And that, like, not everything that I do that I own. Let me go back and sort of amend that. The stuff that I do for advertising agencies, they usually want to do total buyouts because they want to use it as long as they want to, and I don't sign it, and it's advertising.
Right.
But anything that's that I'm very proud of and want to, you know, put my name on, I don't sell. So,
okay, I got it on that.
But yes, when it comes to inspiration, there's no telling when it's going to hit me, but it usually it comes in a flash, and then I'll sketch it and then revisit it later. A lot of the stuff that I do for Insane Clown Posse is not only I help them design their logos now. It used to be just solely one of the band members did that, and now they brought me sort of into that to help them sort of finalize these logos. So I know what they're going to look like months and months before the fans ever get a chance to see them. So I start trying to visualize what I know the fans are going to want to see. And usually as soon as they see the logo, the next question is, I can't wait to see what, you know, Tom Wood's going to do with this. And I've already got a head start, because you have to, it's all about timing. You got to sort of, and I've learned a lot from watching them, because they sort of hype things up and they release it. And there's a, they call it, you know, heat, because there's a lot of attention on it. And they've learned a lot of their marketing techniques from wrestling, professional wrestling. And so they'll amp stuff up and they'll just give little taste of it, and they won't release it right away. And then they'll just unveil it, and there will be a lot of hype for it. So, you know, I know that when it's hot, you know, I need to start having my product ready to unveil shortly after that. I don't want to steal any of their heat or steal any of their sales from their albums or tours. So I'll wait a decent amount of time, and I'll communicate with them to make sure I'm not stepping on any toes, and then I'll unveil my stuff. So, and that's how we've done it for years.
I get it. That's amazing. Now, when we originally met you, like I said, at Dragon Con, I think there was, you had seen some of the different art that we had from our, because that's how you met Sarah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And it was, we had their books, we had the pulp covers, and we had the various books that we had. What was it that Sarah first, how'd she first ensnare you?
It wasn't hard, because she had that backdrop. Of course, she had the books up front.
Yeah.
L. Ron Hubbard, who I knew was a fantastic science fiction writer. But I did not know how much work Frank Frazetta had done for you guys until I started seeing all these paintings. And of course, you know, like I said, Death Dealer was the inspiration for my entire career. So when I seen anything with Frank Frazetta, that, I'm like, is that a print? And then she goes, yeah, that's just, you know, that's one of a thousand. And that's, you know, he signed here. And I'm like, that's his real signature. And so it was just, you know, it didn't take much.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have to sort of bait me in too much to have me, you know, salivating over those prints with Frank Frazetta's signature on them.
He was one of our first judges for the Illustrator
Yes,
contest.
I know that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, when you guys asked me to be a judge, knowing that Frank Frazetta had been in the same position was kind of a dream come true. So,
yeah, it's just, it's because he talked about how both Hubbard and Frazetta both admired each other. So, because Frazetta found Hubbard's work so easy to illustrate. So, because he did several pieces, he did the one for Final Blackout where he took the shot of himself, the Polaroid of Frank posing as the lieutenant for the piece. Final Blackout. That's him. That's a self-portrait.
Right. Yeah.
Where that's that piece. And then he did the piece for Mission Earth, which was the Countess. And then there's one for Battlefield Earth that he did. And then we had several of the other covers for Riders of the Future. and I used to work with Ellie, his wife, to negotiate all the transactions and stuff.
I have to say I'm very envious. The fact that you actually had face-to-face conversations with my hero is just, you know, it's hard to even grasp. But yes, I'm very envious just hearing the stories. And Joni was the same way. She talked about her conversations with just on the plane ride over from the airport to the awards. Joni was telling me these stories, and I was just captivated listening to it. So I hope you guys know how lucky you are to, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, it was just great. And we're now very good friends with his granddaughter, who now has taken over the Frazetta Girls. They got the site, yes. Frazetta Girls. And
I know them well. I've corresponded with them myself a little bit.
Yeah. So she's hoping to be here next year for the Rise of Feet. She said, when is it going to be? I need to start planning right now to come.
Wow.
Yeah. Sarah, the granddaughter. And she has pictures of, you know, with her little baby that Frank was holding her. And, you know, just she loved her grandpa, and her grandpa definitely loved his little granddaughter.
Oh, that's amazing.
But it was just, it's interesting, just as the, what we did with the writers' contest when it was created in 1983 by Owen Hubbard, and bringing on board some of the biggest names in science fiction during the golden age, and it started in 83, but the original ones that were brought on board were the people that were the cohorts, like I said, back in the 50s and 60s. And then when we started the illustrator contest a few years later, Frank Kelly Fries was the original coordinating judge, and he was one of the illustrators from the pulp magazines. He did a lot of stuff, and he really liked doing Owen Hubbard stories because they were so evocative, very easy to do. But like I was saying, that's what the judges that were around at that time that were alive when LRH was alive, and they illustrated his work. You know, Frank had said, nobody does adventure fiction like Owen Hubbard. And Owen Hubbard called Frank just the dean of fantasy art. He loved his illustration, which is why he commissioned him to do those paintings.
That's a fitting title. I've not heard that, but I think that's great.
Yeah, he definitely was that. So now as an illustrator, I'm going to ask you this. Like, what inspired you to say yes to be an illustrator to the future judge?
What inspired me? Well, I've known, like you said, we met 10 years ago. So it's not like I've agreed to come judge for a bunch of strangers. You know, right. I've gotten to know you guys for years. And, you know, I think of you guys as friends. So, and Sarah's been great. And she would talk to me, Tom, you should come do this. Tom, you should come do this for years. And it's usually been, I've been so busy. And then Emily was in school, but now she's in college. And I've got a little more time to be able to give back. And I've not seen any program out there that gives back or pays it forward to artists and the creatives like this program. I've just been floored by what you guys have done for these kids.
Yeah, and it's one thing that's interesting too, you know, Echo refers to them as her kids too, and you call them kids, but there'll be winners that sometimes they're going to be sick. We had one a few years ago who was, he won the contest, he was in his 70s.
Wow, really?
Yeah, because it's blind judging. So all you're going to see is the art as a judge. So you have no idea of the nationality, age, sex, anything. It's just they got it right or they didn't.
Well, good for him. Because you're right. There's no reason that you don't have to start at 5 years old and declare that you're going to be an artist like I did. You can start at any age and mm-hmm. just take it wherever you want it to go. It's really a matter of how much dedication and you're willing to sacrifice to sort of travel that path.
Yeah. We've got one winner in the writer contest this year. They're here right now. And the elder gentleman who is 67 years old was amazed because another winner in there is 17. She's the youngest winner we've ever had for the writer contest. She's brilliant. But, you know, a 50-year difference, and he was just like, he got a picture taken with it, like, you know. But that's what the thing is, just it celebrates art, it celebrates writing, specifically fantastical, you know, science fiction, fantasy, art, or writing. Yeah, Owen Hubbard did a whole lot of research into art, what made it good, what made it bad. And one of the things which several of the people, when they actually finish the workshop, is is, and even when I was just talking with Bea Jackson, who also recently became a judge, she was the grand prize winner in volume 24, and she said, after all these years, the thing that really rings true to me, and it really stood there, is art is the quality of communication. And, you know, it's got to communicate. What are you trying to communicate? And he goes into how much, when's an art piece done? Some people can't finish. They can't say, okay, this is done. And, you know, that whole thing. And she said that's really helped her a whole lot, you know, as an artist, that what you're really doing is you're communicating through illustration or with whatever you're doing there. And it's that quality that makes it sell. Like, obviously, what you've done here has got that amazing quality of communication that it sells, because other people do stuff and it's just like, that's pretty, I guess, you know? But it doesn't communicate anything.
Right.
You know? And you look at some of the masters.
Yeah, I would love to read that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely we'll get that for you. There's a whole book that was put together called Art. And it's just, he goes into color depth. He goes into the mood lines, a whole section on mood lines, what works, you know, all the different moods that you can invoke, and then all types of stuff on the difference between art and illustration, you know, just all these different things there, and quality of communication,
That's
defining
fantastic.
What that is.
Yeah.
Aesthetics, what constitutes that, you know.
Very cool.
Yeah. So on the, so I'm a beginning artist, and I want to get going on this stuff here. I want to get myself as a career as an artist. And my parents say, yeah, don't put your hopes too much in there, or you got friends that say that. What do you do when you're going there and you've got people around you that aren't so supportive? You know, how important is that to be around supportive people, especially as you're starting and you don't have that nest egg already there? You're starting off and you're going week by week.
Right. What do you tell? It's funny. I'm like the only artist within 300 miles for any of these rural kids that want to be artists. So, you know, their parents will call me and make, you know, appointments to come to the studio and let them talk to me and show their portfolios. And, you know, you can tell who's got talent and who needs to work on it a lot. And you certainly don't want to crush anybody's dreams, but, it all comes down to, you know, how much you're willing to invest in that. And, you know, I can point them in the right directions. What I usually tell them is, if you really want to see yourself flourish, try to get a job in an art department that has like-minded, very talented people to pitch yourself against to try to improve. And I think that'll bring them to more of a level than anything that they may learn in their high school art class. And, you know, when I took my first job from Champion, and when I went up to Salem Sportswear to work with the best artists in the field, they didn't pay me enough to really live up there. At the time I got through paying my rent and everything else, my utilities, I had like $11 at the end of the week to live off of. And when I first got up there, I lived—
Top ramen!
Yeah, ramen, mac and cheese. And I, you know, until the crappy furniture I was moving up from Memphis got there, I just, you know, I slept in the floor. But no one ever knew about that. I certainly was not going to call Andy Wood, my dad, and say, "Dad, send me some money." Or, you know, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. I was never going to show any weakness when it come to that. I don't want you to worry. I didn't want them to worry about me. This is going to happen. You know, this is just a little setback, and we're going to make it happen. And I tell them, you've got to be prepared to sacrifice. You've got to be prepared to burn those bridges or burn those ships like Cortez did, and say, this is what I'm going to do, and there's no plan B. So
part of it is that, I mean, you don't have blood in your veins. You've got ink, or that concept of like,
right,
that it's that's your life is art.
It is. And once you realize that, you know, once you realize your mortality, and I think I did around 25, that you only got one shot at this. You know, there's not going to be any redos at the end of this. And we have 20,000 hours on this planet, and you've got to make the most of them. And, you know, just you've got to do it, or it's just, you know, a wasted life if this is what you think that you've been put on this earth to do. So
then, for someone who's just looking at art as a dabble as compared to a dedication, then
yeah, look for something else.
Okay, good. So now on,
I mean, there's nothing wrong with it being a hobby.
No, I'm tracking. I'm talking about somebody that really wants to make it. Say, yeah, I have dreams of being a famous artist someday. I want to be a Tom Wood. You know, I want to be a Frank Cavazzetta or whatever. It's got to be more than just a pipe dream. It's got to be, that dedication's got to go into it. And one thing that people don't really get a lot, or some people don't realize, is it's work. It's actually hard work.
Absolutely.
And so can you talk about that a little bit? Just because it's not like, hey, I'm doodling.
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
You see the kid doodling in class instead of studying his history lessons. You know, he's doodling.
I know, absolutely. I think it has to be almost an obsession if you really want to be good at it. I think that it's something like my entire bedroom when I was growing up didn't, you know, we redid our house at one point and we didn't even put wallpaper up back in my room. It was just every inch was covered with sketches and drawings and tacked up onto the wall. And, you know, that was, that's how my life was. I mean, I played sports. I was on the basketball team and the baseball team. And I was, for the most part, a very normal kid. But when I went back into my room, it was knock this homework out and do a pretty good job of it and then get to the real work, which was drawing and, you know, studying anatomy and looking at the masters like Frazetta and at the time Bernie Wrightson and Joe Jusco and, you know, the stuff that inspired me as a kid that was, you know, so far above my skill level at the time. But that's what I inspired to do, and I was committed to getting myself to that level. And I'm still not at that level. But, you know, those guys are gods in this field. So I don't think you ever reach that level, or at least maybe I don't think you should ever reach that level. You should always be striving to do better.
Well, I know Frazetta was always striving to do better.
Absolutely.
Always trying to do better. So then on, what's your normal work ethic like? What's your normal, how much time do you spend a day on your art? Or I'm going to dissect this a few different ways. So first of all, just a typical work week, how does it go down in terms of your creating art?
The great thing about artwork and having a wide array of different fields that you're still participating in, every week is different. There's no week has ever been the same. But I would say that's probably 30% advertising, 60% fantasy artwork, and probably 10% either training other artists on how to do what I do.
Got it. And then how many hours a day would that be?
I'd say at least 10 to 12 hours. Because even once the artwork is done, then you have to sort of shift gears and then be, you know, dad and husband and farmer. And I don't want to release, I don't want to give away anything. I want it all, you know?
Yeah.
So you just kind of juggle. And if it turns, when you finish at the end of the day at 3 a.m, you know, at least when you go to sleep that night, you think, you know, I've spent this day well.
That's awesome. And then on, so that's the number of hours that you work. To do a typical painting, and you said you do a sketch, and then from a sketch to Photoshop?
Right. I'll usually do a sketch, a pencil sketch, initial concepts, especially if it's for me. I usually don't do 4 or 5 concepts unless I'm working for a client that wants to see an arrange or a different array of looks. I know what I want. I've been thinking about it for days before I get to it. So I do a pretty tight pencil sketch, then I do my shading studies and breakdowns, and then I'll do an ink overlay where I won't actually try to shade it with inks. I'll just do, like, I'll circle areas that I know when I get here, this is what I'm going to do. So I kind of plan it all out with that, with my inking, and then I'll scan it in a flatbed scanner into Photoshop, and then I'll start cutting masks. Back in the day when I was airbrushing, it was, you would cut frisks to airbrush in certain areas. Well, it was a very easy transition going from frisks to cutting masks and saving alpha channels in Photoshop and different layers. So it was, like I said, a very easy transition. And I think I learned Photoshop in about 2 weeks. And
wow.
Yeah. So it was very natural.
And then you just keep on upgrading every time they come out there next.
Yeah. Well, I didn't used to. I think I stuck with in the 90s when I picked up, you know, Photoshop and Photoshop 3.5, I just loved their brushes. So I stuck with them through probably 5 or 6 variations of Photoshop. Just didn't want to do
them. It's up to 10, isn't it now?
Oh, it's CS7 or something like that. Yeah. Maybe CS10, but it's probably 20 versions past from the first one that I picked up. And finally, they, you know, your old program stopped opening on your old computer, and you've got new computers. And now I have to stay up to date with it. They forced me, especially with the subscriptions that I do now. Back in the day, I would always have some IT guy that would have an additional extra serial number that they would just give me, and then I would just get the next Photoshop and not pay for it, like a, you know.
Yeah, but now everything's in the cloud. So
right.
So you have to do that.
That's right. Yeah, there's no getting around it.
They figured it out.
They did. They finally caught me.
Yeah. So on the, how long does it take you to do a piece, like hours-wise, an average piece?
An average piece, I would say probably 3 to 4 days.
And that's working 10 hours a day?
Yeah, probably 10 hours a day. But, you know, I was telling Dan DeSantis that I was talking to him earlier. It's hard to, you don't just stop when you get tired. You have to find these stopping points or you can't sleep, you know, that night. You know, once I get to this and I know how this eyeball is going to look, or is this shadow that I'm planning, is it working or not? I've got to see that. And if it's not, I will stay up however late I need to make sure that it does work. And then right. I'm comfortable. I'm, you know, my mind's at ease and I can actually get some sleep.
And then you're the one that brings home the bread. So then if you need to go to bed at 3 and then wake up at 11, or no, you're a farmer, so you can't do that.
No, I can't do that. No, I've got way too many commitments.
You got your cows start lowing at 4:30 or so in the morning. So 3 o'clock to 4:30 is your sleep time.
That's right. Well, it's not like they're coming into the barn to get milked, since I have beef cattle, thank God. Oh, but okay. You do have to work them early in the morning, because especially in the summer, once it gets hot, they move into the trees and then you're just screwed. So it's a fight to get them out. So everything has to be done in the mornings or in the evenings, and you just have to, you know that you're going to take it the next day. You're going to take it, you know, right in the face, and and you just hope that you'll get that sleep back in the next few days. You know, so it's a pretty good trade off. I mean, I've done it for 30 years, and I wouldn't trade it.
So you're able to get by on your every now and then just the 3 hours of sleep, and
yeah. Well, you know, I try to stay healthy.
Yeah.
And stay in shape. I work out and know that, you know, I can give my, you know, treat myself crappy every once in a while, and I can bounce back pretty good.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So then on being able to juggle between it, because you've got these different things, you got your fantasy, your sports, your underground collection, and your ICP. So is it better for you when you're able to do one of these and over this and over here and over here and just... But the diversity, does that make it fresh for you?
Yes, that's the best part about it, just keeping it fresh. I mean, I love, after doing a series of high-end photorealistic illustrations, to see a company come over and say, design this logo for us. That's simple and it's iconic, and, you know, it's nothing even close to what I've been working on. I love doing that. But after I do 3 or 4 logos, I'm sick of that, and I want to do, you know, let's do an advertising piece, or let's do another fantasy piece. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a nice balance.
That's great. So you've pretty much got yourself a workable system right now that you've built up to. So is this kind of like your ideal scene for yourself that you've arrived at? Not that you've plateaued on your technique, because you're always, like you said, you're always trying to get better and better. But are you happy now with what you've got in terms of these things and where you've gotten to your station in life, that you now you're able to also, like you said, paying it forward now as a judge for the contest?
Absolutely. I think I've had the best life it's the exact life that I wanted. And it may have sort of morphed a little bit from the ideas that I have when I was 25, but I found that this is what works best for me, and I love that I'm excited about every project that I'm working on, and I'm still passionate about every project that I'm working on. So you're right. The one thing that I had started doing probably as soon as Emily started going into school was starting to go to her classes, and her art classes and be able to pay back a little bit. And this is just, you know, a much larger scale of what mm-hmm. you guys are doing. So it was perfect timing.
Which is great. So now on the on creating art in general, so you do this stuff here. One thing I've had come up before talking to artists is like, how do I know how much to charge, you know? And what about discounting? If something's not moving, to be able to discount it. And what's your data on, what's your opinion on that, how that works?
It's kind of all about feel. You know, if you knew that, if you've got this one upstart company that's coming in and you think that their product is going to have potential, but they don't have money to pay the usual rates that you would charge, then it's just you just have to feel it out and think, you know, am I going to give them a break on this? Because I know that if these guys get going, then it's going to be a lot of work, and then you might give them a discount for that. And I've done that with several of the bands that I've seen coming up in the underground scene that don't have the money of, you know, a Kiss or an Aerosmith or Scorpions or ICP. And, you know, I'll cut them some slack knowing that, you know, if I help them get their career going, that I'm going to have this young talent that's going to be asking me for art for the next, you know, 10, 15 years.
Which is great. So now on the, when you work out pricing, like you do a piece of art, and I realize you license everything pretty much unless you're selling it for an ad agency. But do you, when working out how much to charge for a piece, do you work it out like, okay, so I want to be able to think that I'm making $20 an hour. So as a rough estimate, I'll take, if it's going to be 30 hours, I'm going to charge at $20 an hour, $600 for this piece, or.
Right. Usually I use $100 an hour scale.
Okay.
And I kind of just guesstimate based on my decades of experience, because I can pretty much nail it within a few hours, how long it's going to take me, based on their description, plus or minus revisions. And so I'll try to base that off $100 per hour.
And then when you do a contractor agreement, do you put in like for 3 revisions or 5 revisions, or take it as it is, or you don't take nothing?
No, I usually
if put it's in, commission.
I usually put in 3 revisions, but there's nothing I hate more than revisions. I hate them. Once I finish that piece and mentally close the book on it, when they come back and ask me, can you go back and change? It's like pulling teeth, John. I hate it worse than anything on the planet is going back and changing stuff. Even though I have to admit, on rare occasion, the revisions they made actually made it look better. But that's a rare occasion.
Right. But it's in the contract, 3
right.
revisions, and...
And then, yes, then we'll start negotiating for more money.
If they want a fourth.
Right.
So, because something with, sometimes with, you know, when they're going in and starting as a fresh, they'll take anything. You know, someone's just hungry and they just want to do my art. So they go to some of these websites where, you know, we'll meet you up with clients, and then they just get taken to the cleaners as an artist.
Right.
Are there any things that you recommend to stay clear of?
As far as some of these websites that want you to come in and bid on these projects, and you're bidding against kids that are selling artwork or logos for 99 cents, just stay away from them. I would say, once you get your portfolio up to a point to where you can go to work for a company where you're going to see yourself grow and you'll have financial security while you grow, or find a good agent that's going to go out there and fight for as much money. If you don't have the experience and knowledge to negotiate yourself, find an agent that'll do it at a decent rate. And if this agent says, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to take 50%, then you need to find another agent. You need to find somebody that's going to be around 25 to 30% maximum. You know, let them, because you want them, you know, don't be greedy. Share the money if he's going to go out and work for it,
yeah.
Work for it and bring you the agent or bring you the companies that you want to work with. And that's just part of the business.
Okay. Well, that's great. Well, this has been amazing having a chance to chat with you on this time.
No, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And I think we're going to be having more conversations down the road, because we just, this is just a cursory going over all those different things, and each one provides, there's easily five different channels I could have really, you know, dug down into, but this is really good as an introduction to you, and also just as a an overview for aspiring artists, starting from, like you said, you started from a rural town, dirt poor, and you've taken it from there, and just from your own dedication, hard work, and persistence, you've taken it and you're living your life.
Right, right. Well, our entire community was certainly poor farmers. I mean, we were middle class, I would say, like most families were. There was none of us were upper middle class or rich, but yeah, there was, our school system was so broke. The idea of art classes or any mentorship at all in that situation was just non-existent. So yes, I was very lucky, and certain doors opened and you had to be prepared to walk through them, and I'm sure luck had a big part of that too, and the right people at the right time. So yeah, I've been very fortunate.
Which is awesome. Well, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Writers of the Future podcast is available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Player FM, iHeart, and Spotify, and it's been globally syndicated on the United Public Radio Network. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.